Alberta's Child Protective Agency's new designated leader comes from within the agency. Good morning, I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. Mike Carroll currently runs the Department of Children and Families operations in Tampa and Southwest Florida. Governor Scott nominated Carroll to take over DCF as lawmakers consider spending more money on child investigators. Florida parents, school kids, and teachers await to see what next school year's assessment test focused on Common Core state standards will be. While they wait, they're watching New York state parents opt out of Common Core testing. And the stars and bars in Tallahassee. Why were Confederate flags in the rotunda of the state capitol? It's all ahead on a WLRN special, Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014, a WLRN special examining the Florida State Legislature in its final week this week of scheduled work. Good morning, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Coming up in this hour, Governor Scott makes his choice to lead the Department of Children and Families. That's the agency which is undergoing another round of reforms from Tallahassee. We will talk with the guy nominated to lead the DCF. Parents are opting their kids out of state education assessment tests as big questions continue to surround what those tests will be, what they'll look like in Florida next spring, and add the Confederate flag to the Pabst Blue Ribbon beer pole and the big bowl of pasta on the list of displays that have appeared in the state capitol. All that ahead on here, our Sunshine Edition, Session 2014. Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Edition. This is the Sunshine Edition, Session 2014 on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Kayla McKean was 6 years old in 1998. She'd been living with her mom in an Orlando suburb until April of that year when she moved in with her dad and stepmother, just west of Orlando. If it weren't falling off her bicycle, it was the dog. Bruises, black eyes, scratches. She fell down doing jumping jacks. She bumped her head on a door jamb. Those were the excuses given to child welfare investigators in the spring and summer of 1998. It was Thanksgiving Day when authorities got a call from her dad. Kayla was missing. Her body would be found in the Ocala National Forest in a shallow grave. Her father, Richard Lee Adams, would be convicted of first-degree murder. He's currently serving a life prison term. Kayla's murder led the Florida State Legislature to passing the 1999 Kayla McKean Child Protection Act, a sweeping set of reforms for the Department of Children and Families. This case, now 16 years old, is the case Mike Carroll first mentioned when asked what child death he remembers first. Carroll was named yesterday by Governor Scott as the interim secretary of the DCF, an agency Carroll has worked for since 1990.
Kayla McKean was the first one that really struck a chord with me because of the brutality of it. But there are many, many cases that we have looked at over time. And I guess the ones that I have the most regret, because one of the things I always ask when we look at things and we get bad outcomes for family, is look at our involvement and intervention in it and try and figure out if we had done things differently, would we have come out with a different outcome? And in those cases where you can definitively say, oh my, in this case, we might have had a different outcome had we done things different, those are the most difficult, I think, to swallow, because we're in this work to protect kids.
As of Monday, yesterday, Mike Carroll will ascend, rather as of the coming Monday of next week, Mike Carroll will ascend to the top spot of the Child Welfare Agency as it's reeling again from problems. A Miami Herald investigation detailed the deaths of 477 kids in the past 6 years who had had contact with the agency. Those deaths come more than a decade after Kayla McKean's and the reforms that followed her tragic murder. Carroll currently is the regional director heading the agency's district covering the area stretching from Tampa Bay south. If approved by the state Senate, he will succeed Esther Jacobo as secretary of the Department of Children and Families. We spoke with Carroll from his office in Tallahassee.
We have got to do better within our agency at keeping kids safe. And I think under Secretary Jacobo, we've started some of those initiatives, and I would like to continue them. I'm also hopeful that what's going to come out of this legislative session, including the additional resources that will be in play that will help us to reduce caseloads, that it's going to make it more possible for us to do better work. But I do think in the short term, we really need to focus on those families that we're working with right now. And we need to be particularly diligent around families that have children that are 3 years and younger. And in these families, particularly if they have a multitude of complex problems, substance abuse, domestic violence, behavioral health, we have to be very careful in our decision making, and before we make decisions, have adequate information to make those decisions. So the implementation of the new methodology, where we're moving away from incident-driven investigations to a more thorough investigation of the family, I like to equate it to going away from snapshots to looking at the motion picture of the family. In the short term, until we get there, because it's a big cultural change for us, that's going to include hiring additional staff. It's going to include changing the way we do training, which we've already done much of that, but we have more to do.
Let's talk about the caseload and the training here. We spoke with who will be your lieutenant, Pete DeGree, the deputy secretary of the Department of Children and Families, during a Miami Herald WLRN town hall focused on the Innocence Lost series, an investigative series. And he told us that he was not shocked by the Herald's documenting of 477 child deaths. Take a listen here, Mike, to what the deputy secretary of the agency had to tell us a week ago.
As I look at it, I see several things. I see a little bit less of the trying to keep families intact because safety has always been the priority. I've never heard anybody say that safety is a secondary priority to family preservation. However, what I have seen is an awful lot of is child protective investigators and case managers with too much work to do. Right now, today in Miami, the average CPI has 18 cases. So the single most important thing that can be done is to adopt the governor's recommendations, which gets our child protective investigators on the whole to a caseload of 10 families, which is still too high. I'm telling you, in Los Angeles, it's 7.5. In New York, it's 5.
So, Mike, does the Senate proposal of $47 million in additional funding for the Department of Children and Families for the next fiscal year get there in terms of the caseload, bringing it down for case investigators?
I haven't seen the Senate proposal, the budget fully vetted, because I haven't been directly involved in that. It's my understanding that it would get us to a level where we would be 10-1. It would not include one of the other proposals that came through the governor's office was that we have dual CPIs, much like law enforcement would have, in those cases that involve three-year-old children and younger that had multiple risk factors. And so I'm hopeful that when all is said and done on Friday, that it does include the resources that we need. But I don't know at this point.
You're a veteran of the agency. There's been some talk of requiring a social work degree on the part of child investigators. Is that a proposal you'd support?
I think that what we need is folks that have some understanding and have a social work or related social services degree. To me, it's much more important that folks that we get have the analytical skills to make sound decisions based on the information that they gather. And the evidence that we show doesn't show necessarily that folks with a bachelor in social work make better decisions given the tasks that we're going to have them undertake, particularly involved in a protective investigation where you're in and out. You have 60 days to investigate a case, to put this information together, and then to make some decisions. So regardless of the degree that they come to us with, now we would like folks with degrees, we would like folks with experience, but boy, I need some folks with a lot of common sense. I need folks with very strong analytical skills. I need folks who aren't going to be afraid to partner and listen to folks. One of the things that we do in child welfare a lot, and what I'd like to see more of, is the staffing of cases where we bring multi-disciplines together to talk about where we're at in a case, and we get multiple inputs along the way. And if you look at the way our system of care is set up, everything from the child protection team to law enforcement that does a lot of these investigations side by side with us to our service providers that are providing interventions and assessments for us, it's absolutely critical we have these folks at the table. And so we need somebody that has the analytical skills, but also the ability to listen and learn from other folks and then to make decisions based on that. I would say that I would make it an emphasis for us to try and recruit folks with Bachelor of Social Work degrees, but to require it, I don't know that that's going to help in our recruiting process. I don't know if I'm going to be able to fill the positions as quickly as I could otherwise. And I don't know that I'm going to get the bang for the buck that folks have said.
Mike, finally, how will you know when the reforms have taken root in the agency?
Everything that we're doing now, it's really about families we touch now. And so there have been cases that we've closed, for instance. And it may be if the litmus test is that we're looking at cases that we had prior contact with, well, if we closed a case 4 or 5 years ago or even 3 years ago, none of the changes that we've made now would be able to impact those cases. So much of what we do now is how we're interacting with families and going forward. And so I think the litmus test now is to be looking at those cases that we have open active investigations, open active service cases, and then going out from a point in time to see how these improvements are impacting services and what type of outcomes we're getting, quite frankly.
The Secretary-designate to lead the Florida Department of Children and Families, Mike Carroll, he also explained how he changed how he reads child death cases, evolving from really solely an analytical point of view to something more emotional.
Listen, from a personal perspective, I got to tell you that when I read child death cases before, what I was looking at child death cases for was from a systems perspective. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? But I adopted a child through the agency, through the child welfare system, and that child is now 17. And I can't look at these cases any longer without looking at it through the lens of him, because there, but for the grace of God, go my child.
Mike Carroll is the new interim secretary as of this coming Monday of the Department of Children and Families, awaiting confirmation by the Florida State Senate. Carol Marvin Miller is an investigative reporter with the Miami Herald, one of the investigators behind the Innocence Lost series. Carol, Mike Carroll talks about looking forward in his assessment of the agency. Is he missing an opportunity by not looking back?
That's a tough question. You have to understand your past to not repeat mistakes in the future. And I think that's a valid question. One of the things that surprised us, as you pointed out from the town hall meeting, was that Deputy Secretary DeGree acknowledged that many or most of our findings were not particularly surprising to him. And that would be true. Mr. DeGree is heavily involved in the review of child death cases. Mm-hmm. And so he would have been looking over time at the same records that we were looking at. What is confounding is that you can view those records over a long period of time and not make the necessary adjustments. And that is exactly what we found. One of the best examples of that includes the use of these so-called promissory safety plans, where investigators would go into very troubled homes where parents were addicted to drugs, where, say, a father was violent toward his spouse and or children, and they would ask those parents to sign pledges to stop doing drugs or to stop being angry and violent. And, of course, those things seldom work because you can't expect to cure a drug addiction on a promise.
Right, a promissory note may not work. Carol Marvin Miller, let me ask you about Mike Carroll and his appointment by Governor Scott. He has a long history with the agency. By your assessment, is he the leader to lead the reforms that are likely to come out of Tallahassee this week?
I don't know. I don't know Mr. Carroll very well. What's striking about this appointment to me is that Mr. Carroll is to be yet another interim secretary. Esther Jacobo, who took over the reins of the agency a little less than 10 months ago, mm-hmm. was brought in as an interim. And Governor Scott has had all of that time to find a permanent replacement. And yet, what he announced yesterday was the appointment of yet another interim secretary. I don't know why that is, but you'd like to think that after close to 10 months, the governor would have had enough time to find a permanent replacement to lead this agency forward.
Could it be because of the election calendar coming up in November that any secretary naming may be interim in reality, given the outcome of the November gubernatorial election?
Well, that's certainly one of the things that I heard much of the day yesterday. But yeah. If you are Governor Scott, certainly you have to have the confidence to think that you will be the governor past November. And you'd like to think that there are people out there who are passionate enough and interested enough to take this job, knowing that it may not be a permanent one.
Carol Marvin Miller, investigative reporter behind the Miami Herald series Innocence Lost, joining us here on the Sunshine Edition. Thank you, Carol. The child welfare system has been under scrutiny here in Florida for years with stories of missed opportunities and bad judgment. Certainly these stories are tragic. They really are shameful. And there are also stories of redemption and stopping the horrific cycle of abuse.
My name is Heather Rosenberg, and I live in Crawfordville, just south of Tallahassee. My experience with the system actually spans back 3 decades with my own family. My mother and my stepfathers should never have had children. They should never have been allowed to raise children. They were alcoholics and had a drug problem, and there's mental illness issues there. There was domestic violence that was rampant. It wasn't until my mom's very downward spiral towards the end, when I was a middle teen, that my father's side of the family was finally successful in ferreting me away. And actually, I went to boarding school for high school. So that was the only thing that saved me.
So why don't we dream about that?
We fostered about a dozen children and have actually adopted 3 of those children out of the foster care system. I have the experience as an abused child. I have the experience as a sibling. I've been a foster parent. I've been an adoptive parent. And in the last few years, I've been a fierce advocate for the rights of children in the system. We don't allow people to operate vehicles under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Well, if it's dangerous to operate a motor vehicle because we have poor judgment skills and bad reaction times, children are far more complicated than a motor vehicle. People are afraid to get involved in the issue. It's a depressing issue. It's such a big problem. They have no idea what little steps we could make to make a big change and a big difference.
Heather Rosenberg sharing her story from a child in need of protection to an adult opening her home for shelter here in Florida. Still to come on the Sunshine Edition, as Florida public schools transition to Common Core state standards, New York State already has. Some parents are opting out. Could that be Florida's future? You're listening to the Sunshine Edition here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Edition. Florida and Utah don't seemingly have a lot in common, right? Florida's highest point is not quite 350 feet above sea level. Utah's lowest point is more than 1,500 feet higher. Utah has 612,000 public school kids. Florida has 4 times that. But there are some vague similarities between the Sunshine State and the Beehive State. Florida has about 1,200 miles of coastline. Utah can have thousands of miles of shoreline, too. Of course, its water is far saltier than the ocean waters surrounding Florida. And Florida school kids next year will take assessment tests designed for Utah kids. Florida is spending more than $5 million with the state of Utah to license its test materials, giving the Sunshine State 1 more year to develop its own state test focused on Common Core state standards. John O'Connor covers state education policy for State Impact Florida, WLRN, WUSF. He joins us in Tampa. Before we talk about the test itself, John, how did Florida find itself with no assessment test for next year?
Well, this was somewhat planned. When Florida adopted the Common Core standards, the plan was all along that FCAT, most of the FCAT would go away after this year. And so the question was, which test would replace it? There are 2 multi-state consortia that are designing tests using federal grants. One is called the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. The other is called Smarter Balanced. Florida was part of PARC. In fact, we were managing the money for PARC for several years. But as the opposition to Common Core grew in both Florida and across the country. There were some concerns from the activists about the fact that PARC is federally funded. In fact, the federal government, the Department of Education, does have some veto power over what can appear on the PARC test until the money runs out later this year. And so because of that, some folks were concerned about federal control of the tests. Another issue was PARC was going to take longer than the current FCAT exams and was probably going to cost more. Possibly cost more. And so there were some concerns about that. And because of that, you had both the legislative leadership in the House and the Senate saying they wanted Florida out of this coalition.
Right.
The governor joined them several months later. And so Florida then had to put out for bid whatever its new test would be.
We essentially needed a longer runway to get the Florida test up and running, perhaps not next year, but the year after. So what do we know about the Utah test materials that Florida will be licensing?
Well, there's a very important distinction to be made here is that Florida is not going to use Utah's test. What they're going to use are the test items. And why it's important—
What's the difference, John?
Yeah, here's why it's important is because Utah is using what's called an adaptive test. So an adaptive test is different than what Florida kids are used to with the FCAT, because when you answer a question, if you get the question right, it gives you a harder question. If you get that question right, you get an even harder question.
Right.
If you get it wrong, you get a less difficult question. And so adaptive tests allow students to, it kind of hones in on where a student's level is. In general, it's, fewer questions. It's a shorter test. The GRE is an example of an adaptive test that's been used for several years. Florida is not using an adaptive test. They're going to use a traditional test.
Does that mean paper and pencil? Adaptive test has to be computerized by definition because it's changing the next question based upon the answer to the current question.
Right. The plan is for Florida to use online tests because some of these questions will be what are known as performance tasks. The students will have little puzzles to solve or interactive things to try and manipulate to solve the question. So the goal is for almost every student in Florida to take these next generation of tests online.
John O'Connor covering state education policy for State Impact Florida, joining us from WUSF in Tampa Bay. Now, we are looking ahead certainly already to next year's testing, even before the results of this year's FCAT are in.
Next week, you're going to have an opportunity to do great again, right?
Yeah.
Who's going to do great?
That's in Hillsborough County, the superintendent there, just a couple of weeks ago, pumping up students at West Tampa's Graham Elementary School, getting ready for those dreaded FCATs, the last class to take FCATs in Florida. The great majority of Florida public school students have taken the FCAT since it became the measuring stick back in 1998. Next year, there will be a new measuring stick to conform with the new Common Core standards. New York public school kids have been taking Common Core-oriented tests for 2 years now. Jeanette Duderman is from Belmore, Long Island. She's with the New York State Allies for Public Education, a parent group opposed to excessive testing. She joins us from the studios at the Radio Foundation in New York. Jeanette, your oldest son took the first round of Common Core-based testing in the third grade. What was that like for him?
It's difficult because you have a child who's 8 years old and sitting for hours upon hours upon hours of testing. The teachers clearly are very nervous before the testing comes up. These are new to the teachers as well. They don't know what's going to be on the test. They don't know at that point, this was 2 years ago, had no materials even about what was going to be on the test or to even prepare the children for the test. So the kids are hearing months and months beforehand, leading up to the test, you have to do it this way to get it right on the test, and you can't do it like that, you got to do it like this. So the kids are hearing this language of, everything is about the test. They're test prepping from January and sometimes even starting in the fall on.
Sure.
For an eight-year-old, they can't process what this means and what it doesn't mean. And so all they know is that this is a really big deal. And if I don't do well, this is really bad.
Shafiza Munab also joins us here in South Florida. She's a Broward County public school teacher teaching sixth through eighth grade. This year, Shafiza, you're teaching teachers about the coming Common Core state standards. Your response to a parent, to Jeanette, about concerns about test prep and the concentration on tests, is it unique to Common Core? Is it unique to any state assessment test?
Well, I think that it's extremely important to prep a student
because if you do not prep a student, you're allowing the student to fail in the process. Like anything else.
Well, no prep doesn't necessarily equal a failure.
No, it doesn't.
Right.
But it allows the student to be more prepared for what is to come. It is inappropriate to put student in a testing situation when they have no clue what's going on. For example, last year at my school, it was the first year where our students were taking a test on a computer. Mm-hmm. And although we are living in the computer age right now, and all of our students know everything there is to know about computers, probably more than we do, we wanted to make sure in our school that our students were extremely prepared to take this test. So instead of doing the pencil and pen preparation, what we did was we actually had the students do the preparation on the computer.
Got them comfortable in front of the screen.
Correct.
Ahead of actually taking the test. Laura Zork is with the group Florida Parents Against Common Core. She joins us here on the Sunshine Edition from Vero Beach, Florida. Laura, you oppose Common Core as a concept. Why? What standards do you oppose?
Well, actually, we have looked at Common Core extensively, and we found that the standards themselves are mediocre in quality and rest on questionable philosophies.
What standards do you find mediocre?
Well, if you want to look at specific standards, you can go into the math standards and in the elementary. It's been found by the experts that it's very age inappropriate. The math standards are. Also, we're looking at in the English language arts, it's also doing away with a lot of the classical literature, and we're replacing that more with informational text. So as parents, we're not comfortable with that. But there are many experts that have come out against Common Core that were even on the validation committee that would not sign off on it, but their concerns have been ignored, and we're definitely concerned that Common Core state standards are not as high as the as what we had here in Florida prior to this. There was even a study by the Fordham Institute, who was given heavy funding from the Gates Foundation, that did an analysis of the Florida standards prior and the Common Core state standards, and they even stated that in math, Florida was higher, and with English language arts, we're right. We were very competitive with Common Core state standards. So,
Laura, I'll have the public school teacher respond to some of your concerns. But first, Jeanette Deuterman from Long Island, whose son has taken state assessment tests based upon Common Core. Are you opposed to the Common Core standards, or is it mostly just the process of the high-stakes testing?
Well, it's kind of all a package, and they've put it into a package, and they refuse to separate any of these things that are causing all these damaging effects. So we can't separate them either. When I first started this, I too was saying, okay, well, let's just look at the standards, and let's separate testing and the data mining and APPR, which is our teacher evaluation plan. Let's separate all those things and look at them individually, but. Our state ed department is refusing to separate. Everything has to come all in one giant package.
Yeah.
And that's what's really causing the problem, is that they didn't just try to introduce some new set of standards. They introduced the new set of standards with the excessive testing, high stakes in nature, tying it into teacher evaluation, getting the kids' data and selling it to third-party vendors.
Let me get an idea here, because we've had the FCAT here, which is a state assessment test in the state of Florida for the better part of 16 years, which some will argue is a high-stakes test, certainly. Shaviza Munab, who's a Broward County public school teacher, school grades are associated to the outcomes of this test. I mean, Jeanette, high-stakes testing has been a fact of life in many, many states. It's not new because Common Core state standards are coming into public education.
Right. It's the age appropriateness of it. We used to have a fourth and an eighth grade test.
Mm-hmm.
They were 70 minutes each, and that was it for our third through eighth grade, or actually kindergarten through eighth grade. Now, our kids from third through eighth every single year, the ELA and the math test, our kids, our third graders, are taking up to 9 hours of testing over a two-week period.
And Jeanette, I do want to talk to the Broward teacher here in a moment, but is it the amount of testing that you're concerned with? That's what I'm hearing, as opposed to
the tests themselves. It's the volume. Is that right?
No, there's a bunch of different components.
Okay.
There's the amount of testing. There's what, you know, what the tests are being used for.
Okay.
They're no longer about our kids. They're about punishing the teachers and schools.
All right. We've got a teacher right here, Shaviza Munab, with the Broward County Schools. Do you feel that way? Do you feel the tests are about you as a teacher and your colleagues?
I think that it depends on the teacher. I have to admit that I just recently wrote an article on the Huffington Post regarding the VAM scores, which is
those are what?
The value-added model scores, mm-hmm. In which is added to the teacher's evaluation. And the way those particular scores are calculated is highly inappropriate. In fact, no one actually knows the formula that is used for those scores. But regarding the Common Core.
Yes.
The Common Core, the standards that are utilized in the Common Core, I'm going to speak to the person who is opposing the Common Core as a whole.
Laura Zock with Florida Parents Against Common Core.
So, mm-hmm. Laura, I'm also a Common Core trainer. And I want to let you know that the teacher has the opportunity to use, you know, any type of material to teach these particular skills. For me, when I go into the schools, I actually use Dr. Seuss's Oh, All the Places You Can Go. For the elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, you can use various documents to teach the core. It doesn't necessarily have to be a specific type of document.
So you're not you're saying that the teachers are not limited to a very specific curriculum.
Correct.
Versus trying to take what they deem appropriate for their class to reach the Common Core standards.
Correct. The way the standards are set up currently, it allows the teacher to have more ownership of their classroom. No longer is the teacher mandated to teach X item day one, X item day two, etc. Now the teacher has to ensure that the student is understanding and comprehending for long term. They are now allowing for the standards themselves allow for deeper learning of the material the students are taught to allow for success in the future, long-term success, not just let me study for a test.
Shaviza Munab, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Can I just cut in for 1 second?
Well, I would like to comment too.
Hold on, go ahead, Jeanette Duderman.
Yeah, you know, when you say that it allows for deeper understanding, it's actually doing the exact opposite from what we're seeing. What we're seeing is that mm-hmm. the teachers are under so much stress to pack this material in by the time that the tests roll around, is that now teachers are saying that, you know, before, if the class didn't seem to grasp the concept, which now is happening more often because these standards that were once third grade standards are generally now second grade standards or even two grades below. That's what we saw with the shift of Common Core. So now to get those second graders to understand maybe third or fourth grade work that before was third or fourth grade takes them a lot longer to grasp those
Jeanette,
concepts,
I'm
confused. The teachers don't have the time.
On one hand, you're saying that the test for third graders is testing on first grade material, and the test for second graders is testing on fourth grade material.
No, I didn't say that.
So your third grader, your 10-year-old, your assessment was the material that he was tested on was appropriate for what grade level?
They're saying what the teacher, we don't see the tests. Teachers don't see the tests. Nobody is allowed to look at our tests once they're, as they're being administered and even after they come back. Nobody's ever allowed to see those tests. But from the teachers that had to read the test to children or some that like snuck a peek at them, what they are saying is that a lot of the questions were multiple grade levels above what the grade level should be for a third grader.
Okay.
There was many passages that were fifth grade passages that were on the third grade.
Laura
test.
Zork with the group Florida Parents Against Common Core. Please address, the teacher here.
With all due respect to the teacher, she is probably a curriculum specialist, which was hired by the state.
Are you a curriculum specialist hired by the state?
No, actually I'm not.
Well, their teachers are being told in the state of Florida that exactly what she was saying. But if you go outside of Florida and you look at states like New York, Georgia, Indiana, California, you listen to those teachers and they will tell you that the Common Core state standards are more restrictive and they do not have the freedom to teach what they want to teach in the classroom. So what they're finding are these states are wanting, you have over 80 bills that are out there trying to pause it, opt out, get out, because there's so many problems associated with this. And that's the problem here in Florida. We're we're ignoring the warning signs that's already went off in these other states, and we keep implementing a flawed set of standards. So that's what my group is trying to do. We want the highest and best standards for our children. We're not against testing. We're not against standards themselves, but we're against the Common Core State Standards, and we're also against the AIR testing, the American Institute for Research Testing that Commissioner Stewart just announced back in March.
Commissioner Pam Stewart, the Commissioner of Education here in Florida. Let me bring it back to the classroom. Shafiza Munab, you're a 6th through 8th grade teacher. You're on you're not in the classroom this year. You're teaching teachers about Common Core. The lessons that the concerned voices on this program are voicing from Indiana and California about limits in the curriculum for Common Core. You're in the classroom talking to Broward County teachers about Common Core that they're going to put in the classroom next year.
So I just want to stress something. I'm also a parent of a student in public school.
As am I.
And before the Common Core became, you know, the talk or the topic of the day, I was actually implementing those standards in my classroom. So previous to me being out of the classroom, previous to that, for 3 years, those standards were being implemented into my classroom and within my school itself. And I can tell you that I agree with the parents that it's not perfect. Nothing is ever perfect. And unfortunately, in the state of Florida, the teachers are being asked to adopt these standards within their classroom, make sure their students are prepared for these standards. But unfortunately, their districts are not training them appropriately. That's why in Broward County, our union is taking a stance, and we are going into the schools making sure that the teachers just don't know the standards, but they know how to implement those standards.
Shafiza Munab, a Broward County public school teacher, a parent of a public school student, will your student take Common Core state standard assessment testing?
Yes.
Laura Zork, are you a parent of a public school child?
Actually, I have 4 children. I have 2 in elementary and 1 in pre-K getting ready to go in elementary next year.
I've got one of those as well. Will your children be taking state standard testing next year in Florida?
Absolutely not. And we are on a wave right here in Florida to give the parents the information that they need to let them know that they do have the choice to opt their children out, even though that the state, whenever I just received an email from the Matt Carlson, General Counsel, Department of Education, there is a statute saying that all children in the state of Florida that go to public school have to take the assessment. But when you read the statute, it's very ambiguous. So it doesn't have a consequence to it. And right now it's up to the local school board districts. It's up to the principals. We just received a flyer home from our children's school, and it said if you didn't take the FCAT, which I'm not opposed to the FCAT, based on the data security around that being tied to a national testing company. But anyways, on the flyer that was sent home, it said if your child does not take FCAT, then they will not be able to go on the end of the year field trip. So different principals have a different way of forcing you to take the testing, but as long as you let them know in the beginning of the year, your child will not be taking the assessments. And also be careful as a parent, if you don't want your child to take the assessment at the beginning of the school year in orientation, you normally have to sign. They give you a handbook for the county, and make sure you read that.
It's all in there, yeah.
Different, it might be in there.
Different decisions by parents lead to different consequences for the children, for the school, for the parents, for the administrators, and for the children themselves. Laura Zork with the Florida Parents Against Common Core. And Jeanette, we spoke, began the conversation with your child's experience taking Common Core state assessment tests in New York State. Will your child take another one?
No, he opted out last year in fourth grade, and again this year we had our first round of ELA tests a couple weeks ago. We have the math starting tomorrow, and he will not be participating in those. We had over 33,000 students across New York State that refused to take the test. 20,000 just on Long Island.
Jeanette Duderman from Belmore, Long Island, joining us from the Radio Foundation in New York. Ladies, thank you so much for the conversation regarding Common Core and state testing. Still to come on our program here, Sunshine Edition, Dixie returns to Tallahassee flying the Confederate flag over the state capitol. The Strains of Dixie. The song may have been written by a Northerner, but it was adapted by the South during the Civil War and remains tied to the Confederacy. So do the stars and bars, the Confederate flag. Welcome back to the Sunshine Edition here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. That banner can certainly provoke some strong reactions, much like the melody can. Last week at the state capitol, Confederate flags were flying again, and not a whole lot of people complained. Are you okay with that? The Florida Capitol has played host to a nativity scene, a pole made of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer cans, and a display from the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Is the Confederate flag any different from those displays? You can join the conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Edition. Kelly Crocker joins us now. He's with the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the group behind the Confederate flag display. Kelly, welcome to the program. Why the display last week?
Tom, we just wanted to bring awareness to Confederate Memorial Day, which is a legal holiday here in the state of Florida for April 26th every year. And the holiday was Saturday, and we got permission to put our display up on Thursday and Friday prior.
Now, it's probably no surprise to you that that flag is provocative. Was that also perhaps one of the desires behind displaying the flag in the rotunda?
No, sir. I belong to a historical honor society, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and we just wanted to bring awareness and bring remembrance to those Confederate soldiers.
We asked our audience here about their thoughts about flying the stars and bars in the rotunda, and here's a sampling of what they had to say.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Warren Reese. I find the Confederate flag repugnant.
My name is Jack Jones. I see the flying of the Confederate flag absolutely no different than flying the Nazi flag.
My name is Bill Schnapp. I'm strictly opposed to it. There's a difference between Memorial Day that commemorates soldiers on both sides of the Civil War versus a flag that represents racism, bigotry.
Kelly Crocker with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Do you understand those complaints? Do you understand where they come from and your response?
I understand that as citizens of the United States, they have a right to their own opinion. I don't look at the flag the same way that apparently they do. I look at it as part of Florida history, which is part of the United States history.
Representative Perry Thurston joins us. He's the House Minority Leader in Tallahassee, a Democrat from Fort Lauderdale. Representative, welcome to the program. Your thoughts on seeing the Confederate flag displayed in the rotunda last week?
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, Mr. Crawford. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and I think that, you know, my thoughts mirror the thoughts of some of the callers that you just sampled. Clearly, I think that when we talk about honoring the soldiers, we're talking about soldiers from both sides. It's difficult when you have, it's almost like a family fight. You have to come together, and I think that to have a Confederate flag displayed like that is certainly divisive. It is provocative, and to a lot of us, it's offensive. And it's offensive because it appears that we're celebrating what could have been. We're celebrating the difference as opposed to celebrating the lives of the hundreds and thousands of soldiers on both sides who fought for what we have now, the democracy that we're proud to be a part of now, not something that we could have had or something that was negative. And I think, but when I think about it, and I heard the gentleman say it's like flying the Nazi flag, quite frankly, I think our Constitution and our form of government may allow that, but is that what we want all of these youth groups who are coming to the Capitol to visit our state capitol all across this great state of Florida? Is that the message that we want to send?
Representative Thurston, let me ask you about that, because the Confederate flag has joined a list of displays this year in the rotunda that included a pole of Pabst Blue Ribbon cans for Festivus, a made-up festival from right. The sitcom Seinfeld from the 1990s, as well as a big bowl of pasta from a group that called itself the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. So, what has happened to the rotunda in the state capitol?
Well, I think that we probably do need to set some better standards. Certainly, I will be the last person to deny the Pabst Blue Ribbon or whatever the heck it was. And I understand their concern. They may not have the same beliefs as the majority of the residents in the Nativity Center. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is to not respect the rights of the minorities. When we have our brothers and sisters from the Jewish community, and they want to be recognized, and I think that they should be.
Yeah.
I think that's only right. But when you start mocking it or doing things that are clearly outside the realm of what I think is acceptable and respectable, then that's a problem.
Kelly Crocker with the Sons of Confederate Veterans, will you bring back the Stars and Bars next year?
We'll certainly consider bringing it back to the rotunda or to the courtyard. Confederate Memorial Day is a holiday by Florida law. The spaghetti monster and the beer can tree, as you said, those were made up holidays.
Mm-hmm.
This is a legal issue, and I'd like to say that I'm a veteran myself of the United States, of the U.S. Army. I participated in the first Gulf War. Many of our members of our organization are U.S. veterans, and I'm a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot change history. I cannot change my heritage.
Gentlemen, we have to leave it there. Kelly Crocker,
yes,
with the Sons of Confederate Veterans in Tallahassee, Representative Perry Thurston, House Minority Leader, joining us both from the state capitol. Thank you to both of you here on the Sunshine Edition. We've got more to come on the program, including our This Is Where. This is the Sunshine Edition here on WLRN. As we just heard, this is where in the state we celebrate Festivus, a giant bowl of pasta, and the Confederate flag all in the state rotunda. This is also where we celebrate April's National Poetry Month, asking listeners to meditate on geography and include a poem that has the words, "This is where."
Handcrafted. In the tattoo shop across the street from Sports Authority at Midtown, next to the bloke sucking down a Heineken while looking over the shoulder of the artist drawing on his friend's calf like a fisherman scaling his catch, I separate myself from the buzz of the needle and pretend to a tolerance of pain as if all nerve endings were commuted by the lies of a dictator. This is where I commemorate what I have lost in colors far more honest than I remember.
Just one of our submissions in our This Is Where poetry contest. We celebrate it tomorrow at Miami Club Rum, 6:30 p.m. More details at WLRN.org. The Sunshine Edition is produced by Elaine Chin in the WLRN Miami Herald newsroom. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Sound direction by Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.